Tonight I want to talk about the question, what is real? What's actually going on? This is, from the Buddhist perspective, an important question. Buddhism, as a religion, it's a wisdom-based religion, or wisdom or understanding is at the centre of the whole project. With Christianity, at the centre is faith. And obviously Christianity has a wisdom aspect. Buddhism has a faith aspect, but at the centre it's essentially about wisdom, about understanding. So this makes it quite distinct from a Western point of view. It's one of the reasons why, although Buddhism is a religion, people who are not Buddhists happily practice Buddhist meditation, because it's about understanding, coming to some kind of understanding of what's going on. You don't need to have faith in Buddhism as a doctrine in order to successfully practice Buddhist meditation. It's a different emphasis. Now, the Buddha image, if you look at Buddha images, they're meant to convey wisdom, understanding, also peace, serenity, because serenity and wisdom go together. We've been talking about meditation in terms of serenity and insight. Serenity is the calming aspect, where the mind becomes still and peaceful and unified. And it's only when the mind becomes still, peaceful and unified that it can begin to see what's going on. Insight, understanding, wisdom. So they go together. So a good Buddha image conveys both serenity and wisdom, understanding. Now, if Buddhism sees wisdom or understanding as, you know, the centre of its project, what this means is that the Buddha has a particular view of the human condition. He sees the human condition characterised by delusion. He regards the basic human condition to be one of total delusion. Buddhists sometimes feel superior to Christians because Christians have to put up with original sin, which is obviously not a good thing. But what Buddhists often fail to realise is that they've got something much worse. They've got original delusion, which is much worse than original sin. Because if you think about it, what characterises delusion? Delusion is, well, first of all, we don't know what's going on. That's ignorance. Sometimes you get terms like avidya and moha translated as ignorance, but that's actually a weak translation. Ignorance simply means I don't know. Delusion is a positive state of misinformation. Delusion means I think that I know. In fact, I'm convinced I know, but I'm wrong. That's much more dangerous than mere ignorance. If I'm ignorant, at least I can know I'm ignorant, and I can ask someone. And if someone says, okay, if you want to get to such and such, you go this way, then I can say, oh, great, thanks, and go there. But if I'm deluded, then I'm convinced, no, that's not the way, it's this way. You know, heading off in the opposite direction. And people try to explain to me, no, it's, you got it wrong. And I refuse to listen to them because I'm convinced I know. So delusion is much worse than mere ignorance. But for the Buddha, delusion characterises the human condition. The normal human condition is one of delusion. And this is not a good state in which to be. So if you're engaged in this project of insight meditation, the whole question about what's really going on is an important question and a very powerful question, because we don't know. We think we do, but we don't. And I have to say that the older that I get, the more I appreciate the depths of human delusion, my own in particular. You know, it goes very deep, and you can see it in the world, the way that the world is going at the moment, driven by delusion. what's really going on? This is a crucial question. And then from that, what should we do about it? Now, these two questions are closely linked. The first question has to do with view. What do I think is actually happening? The second question has to do with ethics. What do I do about it? How do I live? If this is what's going on, if this is the case, then how do I respond? How do I live? And these two questions are always related, because the view that I have of things, what I take to be real, what I take to be normal, influences the way that I live, the choices that I make. In our view, the way that we see things, conditions the way that we live. So, for example, if I take on the view of the consumer society as presented to me in every advertisement, that if only I consume more, then I'll be happy. If I actually take that view on board and believe it, I will live a certain kind of life in which I'll be scrambling for, you know, the good job, the good house, the latest gadgets, and so on. If I see that view as being a product of human delusion and simply don't believe it, then my life will take another direction and it'll be quite different. So the view that we have, the way that we see ourselves and our world, has real significance, it has a real impact on the way that we live. So it's necessary to start working on view, and this is what insight meditation is all about. This is essentially the Buddha is saying, start here. Start to look carefully at what is actually going on. In one discourse, the Buddha says, whatever is considered by the world as this is true, the cultivated ones have clearly seen this is false. Whatever is considered by the world this is false, the cultivated ones have clearly seen this is true. The cultivated ones are the ones who have some degree of spiritual maturity, some degree of insight. So what most people, the world, take to be true, people with some degree of maturity recognize, see, is false, and vice versa. In other words, if we're on the path to enlightenment, we are definitely part of a cultural minority, no doubt about it. And again, the Buddha takes this for granted too, as just being bleeding obvious. So we don't know what's going on. And this has this not knowing. Once we begin to accept it, of course we could deny it and say, no, I do know what's going on. Yeah, you might not, but I do. In which case, we wouldn't be really interested in this project, not particularly. Maybe we might meditate because, you know, I get calmer and more peaceful. But gaining insight, wisdom, understanding, this would not particularly interest us because we already know. But if we're really interested in this project, then we have already recognized that actually we don't know what's going on and we want to find out. Once we recognize that we don't know what's going on, there are certain implications that come from this. The first is we have to be very wary of our assumptions on the one side and be ready to be surprised on the other. If I don't know what's going on, then when I find out, it'll come as a surprise. If I don't know what's going on, then what I routinely assume to be going on is probably false. So I better actually check that out and be careful about it. We, all of us here, recognize that things aren't right. we recognize that there's a problem. This is what the Buddha calls dukkha. And we recognize that we are part of the problem. It's no good just blaming other people or other circumstances. If we're in this room working on ourselves, it's because we recognize that we are part of the problem. So we have to do something about ourselves. What we're trying to do here is to clarify the situation. What is going on? What is my role, my part in the problem? What can I do about it? We're very interested in finding out what's really going on, and recognizing that we don't know, we are willing to be surprised when we find out. And this willingness to be surprised is an essential aspect of insight meditation. If we're not willing to be surprised, then we won't be really alert to what's going on. But if we're to cut through this delusion, we need to be very sharp. How do we find out what's going on? We find out by practicing presence. The act of staying present with experience. This is what the Buddha is talking about when he uses the term sati, usually translated mindfulness. Often this kind of meditation is called mindfulness meditation, because this mental quality of mindfulness is so central to the whole project. We'll be talking more about it as we go through. But essentially, mindfulness is presence. It's the act of staying present to what is happening. When we start doing this, one of the first discoveries that we make is that most of the time we are not present. We are absent. So I'm sitting here doing something as simple and as basic as feeling my breathing, being present to my breathing. And then suddenly I realize that I'm out to lunch, and I've been out to lunch for the past 10 minutes. That, you know, for the past 10 minutes, I've been absent, not present. And it's interesting that when we are absent, that's when we tumble into past and future. When I'm present, it's just this experience now. I'm just sitting here, feeling this, breathing, seeing, speaking, and so on. When I'm absent, I'm frequently absent in past and future. And past and future is something that we think we know about. We think we know the reality of past and future, my past, my future, where I came from, where I'm going to. And we think that the present is this tiny little space in between past and future. And most of the time, we project more reality into past and future than we do into the present. Presently, I'm sitting here in this room. But what is it that gives this experience now its flavor? In part, it's what I think or anticipate I'm going to get out of it in the future. Yes, I'll spend time here listening to this stuff, doing this practice, so that when I leave in the future, I'll be able to take something really worthwhile with me into my life, which doesn't start until after I get out of here. So we have this sense of the reality of the future and the reality of the past, which actually outweighs our sense of the reality of the present. But when we actually look at what's going on, when we actually start to pay attention, we discover that past and future are no more than thoughts. and their thoughts which arise in the present. In other words, what's real is the present, not the past and the future. But we don't know that normally. Normally, we're convinced it's the other way around. So normally, we're rushing through the present in order to get to the future, which hopefully is going to be a lot better than this. Although we're afraid it'll be worse. So our experience of the present is constantly being charged by this relationship with the future, and along with the future, the past. And if I think about who I think I am, who is it who's doing this retreat? It's all bound up with past and future. My sense of who I am, my sense of what the world is very much bound up with what I think it was and what I think it will be. So our relationship to time becomes problematic as soon as we start to get into this whole project. Most of the time we're not present, we're absent. And most of the time that we're absent, we're in past and future, projecting a reality into past and future, which actually they don't deserve, because they don't have. Most of the time, we're not here. So it's no wonder that we don't know what's going on. We talk in this method about primary object, secondary object. Part of the function of the secondary object is precisely to show us how absent we are. When I'm with the primary object, suddenly I realize that I'm somewhere else. And I make it my part of the project to actually turn my attention to that distraction and look at it and acknowledge it and then come back. That's when I really begin to realize just how distracted I am. If I have a relationship to distraction where as soon as I notice it, I just kind of bat it away and race back to the primary object, then I can somehow delude myself that I really most of the time I'm with the primary object. Yeah, occasionally I get distracted. But if we actually stop and look at distraction, we have to acknowledge, well, actually, most of the time I'm distracted. In other words, most of the time, I'm not here. I'm somewhere else. And this is the normal human condition. And again, it's no wonder that we don't know what's going on. So most of the time, we're caught up in fantasy, which means that what we take to be real now, later on, we acknowledge was not real. But it can take us a long time to really acknowledge that fantasy is not real. Now, it sounds pretty obvious that fantasy is not real, but if you think about your relationship to distraction, when we're distracted, we often drift off into thought. When we're in thought, whatever it is that we're thinking about, don't we take that to be real? At that moment, that's what we think is real. That's what we think is going on. And then suddenly I realise, oh, I'm thinking. And then the fantasy ceases, and I can look back and realise, oh no, that wasn't real. That was just a fantasy. This is real. Sitting here waiting for the bell to go. This is real. And then suddenly I'm off in another fantasy. When I'm in it, I'm convinced it's real. The fantasy always involves me in some form. And when I'm in it, I am real, and in particular, the person in that fantasy is real. We get caught up in narratives and fantasies which have power precisely because we take them to be real. When we're outside, we can recognize that they're not real. But then we immediately slip back in and we're fooled again. I might be having thoughts of anticipation about this retreat. Oh, just settling in and how's it going to go and, Is it going to be too cold, or is it going to be too hard, or will the body survive, or will I get something out of this, and so on and so forth. All the stories that revolve around anticipation. When I'm in the fantasy, all of this seems very, very real. But then when I pull out of it, I can recognize it's not real at all. It was just bloody, bloody, bloody. This is real. But even though I have that recognition, still, the next moment, I'm back in it, and I'm taking it to be real again. If what's going on are just random thoughts or just vague thoughts, as soon as I notice that I'm thinking, they're gone. Have you had that experience? It's like the moment you notice it, boom, it's gone. But when I was thinking, I was in that world. I took it to be real. But it doesn't hold me. As soon as I notice it, it's gone. This sense of reality is fairly weak. Still, it's enough to hold me for a while, but it doesn't hold me for very long. I notice it and it's gone. But other times, the thoughts are much stronger. And I notice them, but they're still there and they're still real. Here, it's usually when there's an emotion attached to the thought. And it's the strength of the emotion that gives the thought its reality. So yesterday or tomorrow become very, very real. More real than this now, when yesterday and tomorrow are associated with emotion. So emotion gives us a sense of the reality of the fantasy. I can be having, say, some kind of agitated fantasy. I recognize the thoughts, that's not real. But the sense of agitation remains. It's somehow more real. It seems that our absences aren't all the same. Some of them are more real than others. Sometimes, as soon as we notice our absence, it's gone. It can't survive presence. As soon as we're present to it, it evaporates. At other times, we're present to it, but it does not evaporate. It sticks around. It's deeper. It's stronger. Here, usually when it's associated with emotion. But even this passes. That particular emotion ceases and gives way to something else. And then later on, we can look back and realize, oh, that wasn't real either. We were fooled again, but this time for longer. So we begin to see that if we examine this question, how do we know what is real? One possible answer, we could say that what is real is what survives the practice of presence. I'm present to something and it goes. Definitely not real. I'm present to something and it sticks around longer, more real. But it goes too. Okay, so not real. It's like reality has depth as well as delusion. So some things are more real or seem more real than others. And the things that seem more real are the things that stick around the longest, even when I'm present to them. So what is real is what survives the practice of presence. When I'm present to something, what is false evaporates. What is real is what is left behind. And this process has a great deal of depth to it. We pull out of one fantasy only to find ourselves in another. In a sense, what we're doing in this practice is peeling off the layers of the onion, going deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper. The deeper we go, the more real we find what's going on. But we go even deeper still and we realize, no, that wasn't real. There's something else. There's something else underneath here which is going on. presence has depth, and we can practice presence, and we can be more and more present. And the way of doing this is by cultivating an intimacy with what's going on right now. We do this by giving ourselves a meditation object. The meditation object may be incredibly mundane, like the breathing or the walking. Now, there's nothing particularly mystical or mysterious. It's just very ordinary and everyday. But this meditation object has the capacity to really turn us around, because it doesn't matter what object we engage with. What's important is the quality of the engagement. It doesn't matter what we are present to. What's important is the presence. It's that quality of presence which has enormous power to overturn things, to change things around. One thing that we're concerned with as we do this practice is the quality of our engagement with what is happening now. Am I really here for the experience or not? I could be physically sitting in this room, mentally 1,000 miles away. You know, I could be really here for the walk down the corridor, or mentally 1,000 miles away. What's important isn't what I'm doing now, but the quality of the engagement with what I'm doing now. So we give ourselves something to do: sit, walk, keep the silence, and so on and so forth. We create this sheltered workshop atmosphere because it's useful, it's helpful, it's pragmatic. But what we're training ourselves to do is to learn to be present, fully, intimately present with whatever is happening now. And therefore, noticing clearly when we are absent. If there's presence, the flip side of presence is absence. We must become familiar with our absences. The fact that we are absent, how we are absent, and even where we go to when we are absent. The more we get to know our absences, the more present we become. What most frequently destroys the quality of our engagement with what's happening now is not what we call distraction, but habit. Habit is the enemy of this practice, not distraction. Distraction is the content, but habit is the enemy of this practice. Habit is the assumed conviction that we know what's going on and the responses that come out of that conviction. When we're lost in habit, we have no awareness of what we're doing, and we react or respond out of that absence of awareness. And when we're in habit, that's when we are asleep at the wheel, without even knowing it. Well, that's what being asleep is all about. We don't know. We've all had the experience of driving a car down a familiar stretch and suddenly realizing that we have no memory of the past 3 blocks. And if we reflect on it, it's pretty scary, because it could be dangerous driving a car having no idea what's going on around you. But then we're still alive, so we must have had some awareness of what was going on. But because the awareness was habitual, it barely registered. We're clearer about what we were thinking about that past 3 blocks than we are about what actually happened when we were driving down. When we're in habit, we are asleep at the wheel. We're on autopilot. And we live most of our lives in habit. Most of our reactions are habitual. Most of our responses are habitual. Our greetings, our speech, the way we treat people, the way we treat ourselves, who we think we are. All of this is the product of habit. But in habit, we're asleep. We don't actually know what's going on. This is why it's vital that in this practice we learn not to take anything for granted. What we want to do is to cut through habit and begin to see what this experience is freshly, as if for the first time. We think we know what it is. We think we know what's going on. But that's our habit speaking and thinking. We think we've been here before. We think that we've had this breath before. So that's when we head off to think of some amusing thought. But even that thought is generated by habit, which is why we're vaguely, hardly aware of it. Which is why if someone taps you on the shoulder and say, what are you thinking about just then? Oh, nothing. Meaning, I've already forgotten. But when I was in it, I was convinced this is real. It's like we sleepwalk through our lives, through habit. And if we are to find out what's going on, this is what we need to cut through. And we do it through this practice of staying present to what is happening right now, using the meditation method as a means of grappling with this. So this is where this whole relationship to distraction comes from. We think distraction is getting in the way. It's not. Habit is what's getting in the way. At least when we know that we're distracted, we are present to the distraction. When I realize that I'm hopelessly distracted, at least I know what's going on, which is I'm hopelessly distracted. At least I'm present to the reality. So distraction is quite important. We can respond to distraction by dismissing it, regarding it as an interruption to my meditation. I'm trying to meditate, but I'm being interrupted all the time by these distractions. If we do that, then what we're doing is dividing our experience into two sections. There's the meditation object, which is good, and there's everything else, which is bad. And then we're treating our meditation object as valuable and useful, and this is what I should study, and not paying any attention to the rest. But, you know, chronologically, the rest is what takes up most of the time. So we're cutting ourselves off from a great deal of what's actually happening, and often the most important part, because it's when we're in distraction that we are most controlled by our unconscious drives and impulses and desires and needs, when something very real is going on. So don't dismiss distraction, but use distraction as a means of returning to presence. When we return to presence, it doesn't matter what is present. It doesn't matter if what is present is a distraction. It's completely irrelevant. What matters is our presence to it. Are we here for the experience or not? If we are here for the experience, it doesn't matter what the experience is. What we're building is this quality of presence. This is happening in the mind which knows this is what's happening. And it's this mind which is getting stronger and clearer and sharper. It's not a question of trying to avoid distraction. It's impossible to avoid distraction. If we think that that's the project, we're setting ourselves up for failure. It's not a question of avoiding distraction. It's a question of returning to presence. So recognizing, I'm distracted. This is what's happening. And presence is much more important than what is present. We tend to be obsessed by the content of our experience. We tend to assume there are certain things which should be happening, and there are certain other things which should not be happening. And then we try to push away what we think should not be happening and try to grab onto what we think should be happening. But this is not a particularly productive way of going about it, at least not in this meditation practice. What we're concerned with here is being present. What we are present to is not so important. It's the presence itself which is central. And certainly we can only be present to what is happening now. We can't be present to past or future. It's impossible. So whatever is happening now, this is it. So it's about immediacy. And immediacy doesn't care whether we classify what is present as meditation object or as distraction. These are just thoughts. What's important is to be present now to what's going on. The meditation object is extremely useful for this. It gives us a stabilizing reference point. It gives us something to settle into. We're doing a lot of work with the body. We do the posture and flexibility exercises in the morning. We spend, work on getting the posture right in the sitting, the standing, walking, lying down. We're using body as a meditation object in order to stabilize the mind. And with this stability, we can then more easily, more readily be present, simply and radically present to whatever is happening. But ultimately, it doesn't matter what is happening. Doesn't matter what we are present to. It's the being present which matters. It's important to avoid being trapped in images of what should be happening. One good rule of thumb in a meditation retreat is to consider if it's happening, it should be happening. That's it. Rather than the other way around. Oh, but it's not supposed to be like this. It's supposed to be some other way. And engaging in that struggle. Just using the meditation method to ground ourselves in what's going on now. The meditation method gives us something to do while we wait for something to happen. But what we're waiting for is already happening, only we tend not to notice it because we're so busy grasping after something else. The meditation method is very useful. We use it, but we use it to become intimate with what is already happening. It's already being given to us. It's already here if we're ready to accept it. For the Buddha, what is ultimately real, fundamentally real, is Nibbana, which is a term, we'll talk a bit more about it maybe tomorrow night. It's the ultimate goal of all Buddhist practice. Whatever it is, and it's the way that it's spoken of in the text is quite mysterious. And there's lots of learned academic argument about what exactly it means. But whatever it is, it's only available now. it can't be available any other time because it is only now. What we think is real is what the Buddha calls dukkha, pain, suffering, unsatisfactoriness. We come here, all of us, because we have a problem and we want to do something about this problem. And this is what obsesses us most of the time. It's not quite right. I'm not completely comfortable. You know, things aren't going quite the way I want them to go. Things are happening that I don't want to happen. Once I solve this problem, then I'll be okay, and so on. You know, this is the mind caught up in dukkha, in pain, suffering, unsatisfactoriness. But the Buddha is quite clear that dukkha is not real. The problems that we have, what drives us, is fundamentally not real. Because when we are present to it, simply and radically present to it, it dissolves. It disappears. Our problem feeds on our absences. The more present we are, the more our problem evaporates. Ultimately, our problem is not real. What's real is this which is happening right now. And this which is happening right now can only be discovered in complete, total intimacy. And this practice that we're doing is basic training in intimacy, learning to be intimate with what's going on right now, regardless of what it is. We take refuge ultimately in the present. What's happening right now? This is our refuge. And this is what we work on. And when we do this, the more that we do this, the more we find our suffering dissolving, just quite naturally dissolving away. So the whole thing revolves around being present. And presence is something which, by its very nature, cannot be postponed. We cannot be present next week or tomorrow or the next sitting period. We can only be present now. Right now, we are either present or absent. As soon as we realize that we're absent, then we can be present to our absence. And we've already arrived. So it's really very simple. In Burma, the teachers would say the yogi has one duty, and that is to note. In other words, to be present. The one thing that a meditator has to do is be present. That's all. Everything else is dressing. All we have to do is be present. If we do that, our problem, our suffering, dissolves. It can't survive presence because it's not real, fundamentally. And what is real will be exposed. It'll start to manifest. And this wisdom, this understanding that we're seeking, will simply emerge of its own accord. Okay, that's enough for tonight. Thank you.